Africa is at a crossroads, and which road its leaders take will shape the lives of billions of people, not only in Africa, but also beyond its borders. Sub-Saharan Africa is facing a number of compound security risks, including demographic trends, ethnic tensions, and environmental change. To address the underlying trends influencing instability in the region, approaches must be multi-sector, integrated, and inclusive of women. So what steps can country leaders and the international community take to facilitate greater participation by women in decision-making? How do we enable young girls today to step up as leaders tomorrow? You're listening to Friday Podcast from the Environmental Change and Security Program and the Maternal Health Initiative at the Wilson Center. In this special series, Africa in Transition, produced with support from the Population Institute, we share insights from experts focused on harnessing the opportunities in Africa's transition to enable a prosperous future. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, we'll hear from Ambassador Philip Carter III, a senior Foreign Service diplomat and former U.S. ambassador to the Ivory Coast and Republic of Guinea. In addition to his long career with the State Department, Ambassador Carter served as the deputy to the Commander for Civ-Mil Engagement at AFRICOM. So, Ambassador Carter, you've had a long and grounded experience working on security in Africa. I wonder if you could start out by talking about some of what you see as the high-priority security threats facing sub-Saharan Africa, but also what's missing in that conversation.
All right. Thank you. One is the perspective one has to take, right? And looking at the question of Africa, one has to kind of understand that you're not talking about just one place. You're talking about a continent, yes, but it's a continent of 54 very distinct countries with thousands of different ethnic flavors and languages that are going on there. And so when you're looking at the question of security, you have to take that into account as well as anything else, on economics, cultural issues, stuff like that, that Africa is a continent full of diverse nations and peoples and societies. But more immediately, you know, responding to the violence and threats of violent extremist organizations such as Al-Shabaab, ISIS, Boko Haram, and AQIM, among others, has taken the attention of governments and militaries within and outside of Africa. And it's clear that the suffering and damage that these organizations have wrought and continue to commit cannot go unanswered. And we have also the challenges of ethnic and sectarian challenges within other parts of Africa. When you go into Central Africa, when you look at the challenges of the Eastern Congo, and the ethnic violence that's there, when you look at the challenges of different groups that are being weaponized through criminal networks or terrorist networks that previously, historically, have been able to live side by side. These are things that are in the forefront of people's minds when they're looking at the issues of the security challenges of Africa. You have criminal networks. It's a big place with big challenges. However, I would submit that our current strategy of like a military response to terrorist organizations or criminal networks is inadequate at best and probably unsustainable at worst. To me, the greatest security threat in Africa is poor or bad governance. And in some respects, you know, these violent organizations, both extremist or criminal, they take advantage of popular discontent. They take advantage of the lack of governance, the lack of services that are there. They stir it up. And as a result, they feed on the popular discontent or disaffection and disillusionment of the youth of various communities, and they feed into it. And I think that is some of the things. Now, what's not being looked at is that issue of governance. And, you know, we have focused in the past and currently on issues of state security. State security is the idea that, you know, we provide security assistance to government institutions, to militaries, to ministries of defense, and that as these institutions become stronger, the people become more secure. That needs to be challenged. That needs to be looked at more carefully. We find that many militaries are there to protect the regime, not necessarily the populations. And the focus on militaries doesn't focus on perhaps what I consider to be the most important security service, security issue institutions in Africa. That's the police services. And I think really what I'm talking about is a shift from this state security concept to one of citizen security, where, you know, if you poll Africans, and there have been polls and surveys of Africans and looking at what their concerns are about security, terrorism isn't on top of the list. You know, it's dealing with corruption. It's dealing with criminality. It's making sure that their daughter can go to school without being assaulted, that their son can go to the work without having to pay a bribe to a police officer, so that that they don't have to constantly look over their shoulder to these instruments of government or crime or criminals that will approach them. It's the daily life of security that people are focused on. And we need to kind of take that into consideration when we're looking at these issues. And, you know, the issue of governance is central to all of that. And I think we need to do more in that area. I mean, we have to look at ensuring that governments are accountable and responsive to the needs of their citizens in a way that is sustainable. And there's a bit of urgency here because there are trends affecting the continent that are going to make the situation even more acute. Demography, for example. The demographic changes hitting the continent, hitting it right now, are going to change the landscape of not just the continent, but the planet. By 2050, there will be over 2 billion Africans. That means 1 in 4 people on the planet will be an African. All right? Africa will continue to be the youngest continent. The urbanization rates in Africa are the highest in the world. Internet connectivity and cell phone penetration rates are some of the highest on the planet. And they're youthful. So by 2050, the average African, she will be living in a city. And what is that city going to be like? Now, against this backdrop of growth in a youthful population and urbanized population, which are all positive factors for economic growth and activity, is huge gaps. Who's going to educate these people? The quality of education, the lack of social infrastructure in Africa is a significant problem. According to the African Development Bank, a report a couple years ago, there is an annual infrastructure gap in Africa of $179 billion. Let me repeat that. $179 billion a year for infrastructure finance is required on that continent. So we look at 10 years ahead, that's almost $2 trillion. And where's that going to go? Where's that coming from? Where is that money, if you don't have it all, where are you going to invest it to have the manifold changes? So in my view, when we look at the security challenges and the things that need to be addressed, we need to look at the soft side of things, as well as continue doing what we're doing with some of the more dramatic and existential threats facing Africans in the Sahel and in East Africa and such. But, you know, investing in issues like girls' education, addressing the issue of gender inequality, these development objectives are actually security objectives. We know that high levels of gender inequality foster violence. And we know that investing in girls' education results in manifold increases with regard to GDP growth and prosperity that is inclusive. We know that when you empower women in a society, you are improving the sustainability of growth, of prosperity, of economic activity, and security. And, you know, it boggles the mind to think that we can ignore over 50% of a population and expect that there's going to be economic prosperity in that society. So you can't do that. And when it comes to the issue of security, you know, greater role for women, a greater role for women in security apparatus, in police forces, in the militaries, in the political structures, are all necessary as a means of providing greater sustainability to what I would consider this development security architecture that's necessary on the continent. And it has to happen now because the people are moving, and they're moving into cities, and they have expectations because they're connected to the world, and those expectations need to be satisfied to some degree. It's a big challenge.
So earlier today, we heard from Alex Uze, you know, who spoke on this panel about women, peace, and security in Africa. And he, you know, one of the main points that he made was the role that local institutions play and need to play, basically, in the future prosperity of the continent. I wonder if, you know, making your point about bolstering governance on the continent. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how we could, you know, U.S. government agencies could work across those agencies to better equip local institutions across Africa to bolster that governance.
Well, I think in many respects, it you have to start at the local level and build up. Top-down driven reform works sometimes, but frankly, it has to have an underpinning. And so I think, you know, Alex is absolutely right looking at these African organizations, these institutions, and how does the United States as a donor country, how can we bolster that effect? So what's your question is. And I think basically the question is to have the data. You know, there's a dearth of data in Africa, but getting the information to these organizations, indicating what their constituencies need, and also testing these organizations. There's a lot of NGOs out there. There's a lot of organizations. But what I found during my time as a diplomat working in Africa was I found is that a lot of these organizations aren't that representative, and that I think that we need to be discriminating in these organizations to make sure that the organizations we're dealing with are truly representative of the communities that they say they represent. You know, I believe that good governance and democracy are social vaccines for a lot of things, but we have to engage in institutions that organizationally represent those values in terms of their representative, they're democratic in their structures, they're inclusive, and that they're data driven. Now, a lot of these things are difficult, but you know, providing these organizations with useful data that they can make a cogent case within their own societies is important. Holding them accountable to the performance of the agreements that are there, but that they have to be inclusive and as that we engage with them with regard to the kind of programming and planning we're going to do. They have to own it. Every time a donor goes in and tries to present something and makes it, you know, if the assistance is driven out of Washington rather than out of the local community, it's not going to be as effective as it could be, if at all. And I think Alex is absolutely right. We have to focus on those organizations. We need to strengthen them. But we need to be critical as well with regard to holding them accountable to what they aspire to be.
Another challenge that came out in the discussion today was the issue of stovepipes, right? Mm-hmm. Across the U.S. government, within agencies in the U.S. Yes. government, not just funding stovepipes, right, but just in terms of what your goals are. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if you could speak to that. You know, you were at AFRICOM for a number of years, you were at the State Department, and you've worked across several diplomatic missions, including in the Ivory Coast and Guinea. So you've had a lot of experience, I imagine, mm-hmm. with those stovepipes. And I wonder if you could talk to where, you know, where you see continued challenges, but where you also see some progress.
I think first of all, you're absolutely right. I mean, my career has been one of trying to knock down stovepipes. Trying to let people look at the fact that their effort in one area has spillover effects, both positive and negative, on other areas that have a feedback loop to them. Back in 2005, I had the pleasure of working in the development of something called the Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership, where it was supposed to utilize all three legs of U.S. power: diplomacy, development, and defense. And that, you know, of the three legs of that stool, development was the thickest leg, with defense being not the thickest. But unfortunately, because of funding issues, because of bureaucratic challenges, it's basically now just a stool with one leg, and it's basically defense, and it's missing a lot of challenges. There's stuff being done under TSCTP, but it needs to be reinforced. I know there's efforts on Congress to look at making that a stronger effort, and I think that's important. But I also think it's important to kind of highlight to folks that, you know, you can't look at a development initiative solely within the construct of that development lens. I mentioned before, you know, investing in girls' education has benefits for security. Addressing gender inequality not only addresses that immediate challenge, but it provides for sustainable investments for the future in the area of security as well, not only in development, but in commerce, but in economic activity, but more broadly. And so I think, you know, highlighting the consequential effects of social investments across a canvas of, you know, economic interests, commercial interests, security interests, I think is critically important. Now, it's not easy to do. and everyone has their own kind of funding sources. I think a lot of our funding is directed from Congress, but what I have also found is that Congress is quite open to having effective discussions about this cross-connectivity, about increasing the flexibility within the various departments, be it DOD, USAID, State, Commerce, to looking at how an investment made by MCC or OPIC or Department of Defense has positive development impacts for USAID and vice versa, how USAID can reinforce our security investments on the continent. I think we need to look at improving that flexibility. I think we need to, just as we need to be more inclusive in terms of issues like gender, just as we need to be more inclusive about the issues of, you know, dealing with girls' education more broadly, I think highlighting that, forcing that discussion, including that discussion both within the Hill and within the executive branch is going to be an important is an important step to making sure that we have all that the tools of our nation, our resources, are being utilized to their maximum level of efficiency, and that we are engaging our African partners, because this is where they have to benefit from, in the same way, that they are inclusive as well.
You've mentioned the importance of girls' education a couple of times, and I mean, that certainly is something that comes out in a lot of the discussions that we host here at the Wilson Center, I think, when we're talking about how to achieve development and security objectives. I wonder, when you go to the Hill, what does that conversation sound like?
It's actually a pretty good conversation. I mean, there's a lot of interest in it. I mean, what I hear and when I see, you know, we talk about the challenges that are there. I mean, look, resources are not unlimited, right? We have what we have, and we have to kind of leverage what we have for the maximum effect. And what I've been trying to do and trying to highlight with folks and on the Hill, and it's been very receptive, is a growing recognition that if we don't address the demographic challenges of certain parts, and I look at the Sahel, for example, where there's violence spreading throughout, but you have countries with incredibly high fertility rates. Niger, it's over 7. You know, average woman in Niger is having 7 children in a country that can barely sustain itself. That is food insecure, that requires food assistance. And, you know, if that is not addressed, you know, you're going to see a Niger with, you know, almost 200 million people in a decade or two. And they're not going to stay there. They're going to move. And this is the same thing in Mali, the same thing in Burkina Faso, the same thing in Nigeria, Chad, this whole sweep. And this demographic challenge is something that we have to address. How do you go about dealing with that? Well, there's a lot of areas to invest, you know, reproductive health, giving women the choice in terms of family spacing and all that. But more fundamentally to me is girls' education. I mean, I'm an economist by training, and I've seen this around the world. You invest in women, you invest in girls, and there is a manifold increase in GDP growth. There's a manifold increase in wealth generation. It's a good bet to bet on women in terms of their education. And as a result of that, you see the fertility rates will drop. As fertility rates drop, the opportunity for a demographic dividend, where the rebalancing between a very youthful population and a working class population is the symmetry is brought back. And there's opportunities for sustained economic growth. And with sustained economic growth, you have sustained prosperity and security and the tools for a government to deal with its own security. So, you know, to me, I look at the issue of girls' education as a smart place to make investments with limited resources, right? We can't invest everywhere, and African governments can't invest everywhere, but they should look carefully at what they're doing in terms of their budgets with regard to girls' education, with regard to addressing the issue of gender inequality more fundamentally. And we have to reinforce that with our assistance. And what I hear on the Hill is yes, and it's bipartisan. Yeah. So it's very reassuring. It's very heartening to see that.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Ambassador Carter.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.